And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. With all the COVID pandemic challenges, the politics in Washington, the insurrection, infighting, the lack of unity, well, the nation got a shot of inspiration last Thursday when the Mars rover Perseverance landed on Mars, just like it was supposed to, 126 million miles from Earth. Well, our guest today worked on the Perseverance, and he also has ties to Juno, Stephen Scott McClure, who is a radiation control manager for NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, managed by Caltech for NASA. And he's also president of the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation and shareholder of Gold Belt and Sea Alaska. Now, Stephen is known in Juno as Scott McClure, and we'll start off, Scott, by having you explain how it is that you have two first names and also tell us about some of your Juno family ties and Tlingit heritage. That's a lot to get started.
Yeah. Hi, Rhonda. Really appreciate you inviting me. A really exciting week this week. Thanks, and Gul Chish for having me. So in the local area, my family called me Scott, always did. And anytime I visit, I become Scott when I'm up there. You can call me either, doesn't matter. In business, I'm typically known as Steve, and I should introduce myself. My Tlingit name is Hanait. I'm Raven Sakai Shlukach Adi. My grandmother was Mary Caesar. She was originally from Haines and settled in the Juneau area. So some people know the Caesars in the local Juneau area. My mother was Amelia Caesar McClure. She actually was the oldest of the Caesar clan and went to Juneau Douglas High School and moved to Seattle to attend college and met my dad there. And history was made, and they lived mostly in the lower 48, but she visited quite often, as well as myself as a young boy. I also worked on my grandfather's fishing boat, the Mary Caesar, for a couple of summers, and get up there quite often, except during this COVID period. I was up there probably every 2 months or so for meetings, but things have changed since then. But I'd really like to tell you that there's tremendous amount of excitement going on in the community across the planet, because we have many suppliers of equipment to the system to see it all go off perfectly. And I can tell you now that we know that that all the systems have checked out. I haven't heard of any problems. Even the Mars helicopter, which will be the first powered flight on another planet, I can't tell you how excited the excitement keeps going as we keep checking each subsystem and finding everything working just fine. My involvement with it was early on, particularly. I was the manager of the radiation effects group at JPL. That group is responsible for ensuring that most of our deep space missions survive the radiation environment. And I was manager of that group during the development of the Curiosity rover, which is really the main vehicle. It's really the Perseverance is very similar to it with different instruments. And what my group did was make sure that all the electronics weren't blown up by cosmic rays, that they could survive a solar flare. That was one of our biggest fears. Was one thing we don't want to have is a solar flare during that entry, descent, and landing, and that would be kind of awful. There are many things that could happen that could have happened that could have doomed the mission, let's say, including... Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask you, we can get into the mission and maybe you can give us some of the backstory on that. But, you know, I just love the name of this rover, Perseverance, and of course, its little helicopter, Ingenuity. You know, it seems like these are words that we need to hear these days.
Yeah, and actually, the Perseverance was named during the COVID, probably during the summer. And what happens is they put out a call to school children to write an essay on what they think the name should be. And Perseverance came back as the obvious choice for this year. And it really was a sign of hope that we will return to normal at some point in time. And quite a difficult challenge to get that launch off in the middle of COVID. We took off last summer for our about 6.5 month journey to Mars. And that was the appropriate name. And Ingenuity, because it was something we've never done before. Just amazing. How do you fly on a planet with 1% of the pressure that we have on Earth? How do you get lift from that? So that one's kind of an experiment. So we're hoping that one will go off good and that will be used in future missions.
So one of the things that intrigues me is this motto for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, dare mighty things, dare mighty things. I think that this does something to us when we dare to do something mighty.
It's our motto has been for several years, and it's because of the kinds of things we do. We don't take lightly the mission, how difficult it is, how we've got me being on the engineering side, getting that rover, getting it landed, making sure that everything goes perfectly right, because you've got thousands of scientists waiting for the science return data that's coming back from the rover. And it's an amazing triumph, and we don't take it lightly. These are difficult things. We wouldn't do them if they weren't difficult.
Well, yeah, I'm going to date myself here. It will disclose how old I am, but you know, I was a teenager when my dad woke me up in the middle of the night to see the moon landing, and you know, I think it affected me my whole life, that moment seeing it and just kind of being excited about what science could accomplish. How do you think that this rover landing is going to affect this generation?
Well, that's very important to us. I'll relate. My experience was I watched the moon landing as well, and it's probably why I'm where I'm at today. We take it very seriously that what young people see, what they hear from these missions, we want to get that out there. In fact, there are 19 cameras on the rover. Some people have seen the actual landing that are there primarily for that engagement of the public so they can see what is done. A lot of those cameras are not there for science. They're there to so you can understand what is being done, how the landing happened. And for a little bit, if something bad happens, maybe we can see what happened. We take it seriously. About 1% of our total budget is into outreach. We go to schools, we send engineers and scientists to explain what they do, how they fit in, and to encourage young people to join in the STEM fields. We certainly have probably a shortage in most of the areas, particularly my area, that we can't find people that have educated themselves into that field. So part of it is just to excite our young people into doing these, to dare mighty things.
And that kind of sums it up. Everybody feels good, especially when they succeed, when they dare to do mighty things. And one of the things that I heard one of the commentators say during the NASA coverage of the rover landing is that really the work is only beginning, and that it's going to be up to the generations of students that we're all watching nationwide. It's going to be up to that generation to kind of answer the big questions. Is there life on Mars? So in that spirit, you know, how should young people prepare for that challenge to dare to do mighty things?
Well, you know, keep in mind that there's just about every kind of job. I don't want to just push STEM, but that's one of our major areas, science, technology, engineering, and math. To do what most of us are doing, you would get your bachelor's degree. We've got one-third bachelor's degree, one-third master's, and about one-third of us, of the people have PhDs. I just have the master's. They need to, if they're going to go into the STEM areas for the science, you should be trying to accelerate what you're doing in high school to focus in on an area. Look at what you really would enjoy. Think of how many different things, activities have to be done to land that rover. Electronics, mechanical engineering, You may go into the sciences and biology. We have astrobiologists. Think of that. How would that title sound to you? I'm a doctor of astrobiology. I work with a lot of people who, from very young age, they tell me that they became focused on what they wanted to do. And I'll relate one particular person. I just talked to her the other day. She is now an astronaut candidate. She came from Columbia and remembers her first being excited about space in general and what NASA does. She was probably 10 or 11, and she migrated to the United States, completed her master's degree, and now she's completing her PhD. And think of that. She migrated to the United States to do what she's doing. She wanted to be part of it, and she's now an astronaut candidate.
So, Scott, you work for a Native Corporation Foundation, and I'm sure you hear about a lot of scholarships. Do Alaska Natives take advantage of those opportunities enough, you think?
I think they could take more opportunity of that. I think we had something near 100 applications last year. I got to imagine there could be more. I'd really like to put a plug in for both scholarships and vocational training. People are forgetting that, but we also need vocational training of people. Remember, even with a NASA mission, we've got technicians, we've got machinists, we've got all kinds of people. And I encourage the young people to look at every possible opportunity for a scholarship. You get them from Sea Alaska and from Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, which is funded. That part is funded from Gold Belt Inc. itself. And we try to, this year was a little bit bigger than years before. We try to grow that as much as we possibly can. But I also have to encourage people to look to everything, any possible scholarship path that they can see. For Alaskan Natives, there's also ACES, American Indian Sciences and Engineering Society, that has scholarships. I know how expensive it is. It's been many years for me, but I put my son's first 2 years through, and he funded the rest of it, and also had to take a lot of loans. And I don't discourage the loans. The jobs, if you're moving toward the STEM fields, these days are starting in the range of about 100K a year. So if you total up 100K in loans, you're likely to be able to pay that off. But you certainly want to complete your area of study.
So are you a rarity in the space technology industry to be a Native American engineer?
I'd say we're underrepresented in total. There's a lot of discussions within my IEEE is our society, let's say, the largest professional society on Earth, 400,000 people. We're trying to focus in areas where we're underrepresented. That could be rural areas, just people living in rural areas, not getting the training, not getting excited about such things, and also minorities, and also women. Those are areas where we do focus to increase the representation. You got to remember that when you do amazing things, let's say, or the first time you do something, you want the best possible people, and they're going to come from every color, every sexual orientation, religious background. We're just like a microcosm of the earth in terms of the people at JPL, but we still see a need, particularly in that for the Native area. I know of myself and another person in the field, and maybe another person at NASA Goddard. You don't run into too many, but we would really like to encourage that, because if we're underrepresented in some area, we're not getting the best people we can get.
Well, you know, Alaska is kind of a backwater place, but yet it's not. We have the Kodiak space launch on St. Paul Island. They're working with a California developer to test drones for cargo. We have extreme land that's needed, extreme conditions to test all kinds of technology. So do you think that we look at that arena enough in our state? Is it, and is there more opportunity for us?
There's certainly more opportunity. And one thing we've been talking about a lot in my industry is we don't need people to be, in a lot of cases, to work at a particular facility. They can work from pretty much anywhere in the world these days. So you got to think of, you could have offices that do technical support. And I mean, doing analysis of circuits and analysis of design that could be located anywhere. The people just have to be trained, and most likely they would spend a few years at a major facility and then earn the ability to work from home. I certainly think with the internet and the connectivity across the planet, cottage industries could pop up. And being remote is not the same anymore. We will have internet speeds across the globe as these satellite companies, which I also support on the side, are developing these internet in the sky systems. So remoteness is becoming much less and less of a problem.
So I would like to take a short break here and come back and then give the listeners what they've been waiting for, to hear your account of the landing and kind of a behind-the-scenes perspective. So you're going to stay with us, right, Steve?
Gotcha.
Okay. Stand by.